This morning we were looking at the first of these 7 points here in the 7-point mind training. So remember, this system of practice called Lojong in Tibetan, here translated as mind training, is a system of practice brought into Tibet through great Indian master Lama Atisha. And so, of course, this system of practice is part of the Mahayana vehicle. So the two main practices of wisdom and compassion, the wisdom practice, of course, is the practice of the Vipassana practice of coming to realize emptiness, or shunyata in Sanskrit. And the compassion wing of practice is the aspiration of bodhicitta. And what is sort of unique in the Lojong, or the mind training system of practice, is the approach used to cultivate bodhicitta is this exchanging self with others. Historically, in India and Tibet, the more common technique taught was this 7 cause and effect method. And this exchanging self with others approach, I think, is very much suited to us in our modern society. So I think this Lojong, or mind training approach, is very suitable for us in our modern society. For that reason, plus the point we'll look at later, the third point, the ability to take adverse conditions into the path as well. So these 2 points, I think, really make this a very suitable approach to practice. And so we're looking at the first of the 7 points here, the preliminaries. So as with any system of practice, when we talk about the main practice, we need a foundation, suitable foundation for that practice. And here in the Lojong, it talked about having practiced well in a systematic order and reached a certain level of the 3 scopes. We saw that in the Lam Rim, we can talk about those 3 levels of making our life meaningful. And extracting out of that, we saw that there are 4 key elements to reflect on as a preliminary, which are packaged in the Kagyu school of Tibetan Buddhism as these 4 thoughts. And we had that, we saw that in the prayers for meditation handout that we were looking at this morning, that very commonly in the Kagyu tradition, as the very first thing we do in a meditation session, is to reflect on these 4 points at the beginning part, so that we can have a good foundation for the actual meditation practice. But of course, each one of those 4 we can cultivate as a complete practice itself and work on that for some time, to really work on, for example, precious human life, to really reflect on that again and again and again and again, so that we can really internalize that. And the same goes for these other 3 points here, the 4 thoughts. And so if we want to have an effective basis for the Lojong, the main practices, the 2 bodhicittas, the emptiness and bodhicitta, then we need to work on these preliminary practices to have a good foundation for that. And to finish this section, I'd just like to read again from this book here, The Practice of Lojong. And when he's talking about the preliminaries on page 27, he then summarizes this section. He says the following: any expedition requires proper preparation if it is to have some hope of success. If we fail to plan for our travels, we will quickly tire of the journey or abandon it and return home. The same hesitation and lack of endurance can tarnish the spiritual path, which is why it is imperative to thoroughly prepare ourselves for the journey. Practicing these preliminaries serves 3 functions. They are good at the beginning, good in the middle, and good at the end. At the beginning, these contemplations encourage us to propel ourselves into spiritual practice. In the middle, they help us to sustain our practice with diligence and vigor, and at the end, they become an aid to our spiritual fulfillment. Many people think these contemplations are too negative and diminish our zest for life. However, this is a complete misunderstanding of their intended purpose. We are not trying to generate an attitude which will make us turn our backs on the world and lose interest in living. These preliminaries are a skillful method for teaching us to live a purposeful and meaningful life. It is precisely because everything is impermanent that we have the opportunity to bring about positive change in our lives. That's why we should try to create positive change while we can, instead of postponing it to some indefinite time in the future when our circumstances might suddenly change. From the Buddhist point of view, to live properly is to lead a life without regret. We will have no regrets if we learn to distinguish the essential from the non-essential ways we conduct our lives and devote ourselves to the essential ones. A regretful life has waste written all over it, while a life fully lived carries all the marks of success. These preliminary meditations are daily reminders of what is important for a meaningful and purposeful life. So some good advice, I think. So again, we shouldn't think that these preliminaries are merely something we might do just a little bit at the start, and then we sort of leave them behind, and then we just get on to the main practice and forget about the preliminaries. Because what you'll find is that foundation that you may have developed a little bit at the beginning will start to crumble if you don't continually work on it. So it's important to put effort into these in the beginning, in the middle, and in the end. And we need to integrate them into our practice. So that's the preliminaries. Any questions about those before we move on to the point two of point seven of the 7 points? Okay, so let's go to point two. So we're on page 3 of the commentary here, in the middle on the left. Training in the two minds of awakening, the main practice. So remember here, the two minds of awakening are the two bodhicittas. And the two bodhicittas two bodhicittas that we're talking about here, of course, is conventional bodhicitta and ultimate bodhicitta. And conventional bodhicitta is what we normally refer to as bodhicitta, this aspiration for enlightenment for the welfare of others. Whereas ultimate bodhicitta, of course, is the wisdom of emptiness, sustained by that conventional bodhicitta. So, of course, here we're talking about the two wings of practice, the wisdom wing and the compassion wing. So these are, of course, the two main practices here, and we're going to be looking at those now. So here the commentary says, the second point, the training in the two minds of awakening, is the main practice. It has two parts, the ultimate mind and the conventional mind. Given the sequence in which meditative equipoise and post-meditation stages arise within a single person, these two minds are presented here in the following order. First, to train in the ultimate awakening mind, there are two parts, the actual meditation session and the subsequent period practices. So, as I mentioned earlier, any practice has two parts, meditation, and then what we do for the rest of the day, what's called here post-meditation. And here, in the meditation practice, it says, it uses this word meditative equipoise. So equipoise here means balance, which means that whatever we're meditating on, we need a balanced mind, i.e. we need a mind that is free of dullness and distraction. So here, when we see meditative equipoise, we're talking about having a mind of shamatha as a basis for, in this case here, vipassana, and later the practice of bodhicitta, of compassion. And so we're going to be looking at these two, how to cultivate these two bodhicittas, ultimate bodhicitta, the wisdom of emptiness, and the conventional bodhicitta, using this exchanging self with others approach. In this text, we first have the training in ultimate bodhicitta and then conventional bodhicitta. You find in some other presentations here of Lojong, they've turned them around. First you have the conventional bodhicitta and then the ultimate bodhicitta. But here we're using this approach. First, ultimate bodhicitta, then conventional bodhicitta. And within each of those, of course, we're going to look at the meditation practice and then the post-meditation, how we integrate that into daily life. So we're going to start with the ultimate bodhicitta practice, the wisdom of emptiness. And first part of that, of course, is the actual meditation practice. How do we meditate on ultimate bodhicitta? How do we meditate on emptiness? And so let's have a look at that now. And so down towards the bottom there of page 3 on the left, the actual meditation session. The meditation session divides into 3: preparatory practices, the main practice, and the concluding practice. As we're going to see later, one of the slogans later, in fact, if we look in the... if you look at the actual root text, it's slogan number, if I can find it. Yes, slogan number 40. There are two tasks, one at the start and one at the end. And that's what we're referring to here, slogan 40, at the beginning in your root text. There are two tasks, one at the start and one at the end. Which means when we meditate, there are two things important, what we do at the beginning and what we do at the end. And of course, the middle. So that's what it's talking about there, the preparatory practices, the main practice, concluding practice. So part of the preparatory practice, of course, is to set a good motivation. And then at the end, the concluding practice is to then dedicate what we did in the main practice. So we're going to look at those. So here then it says, as for the preparation, and now it gives a little paragraph of what to do as a preparation. It says, undertake the 7-limb practice inside your chamber of divinities. Make supplications to meditative deities and your teachers. And having seated yourself comfortably on your meditation cushion, count your respiration, exhalation and inhalation 21 times. With these practices, you enable your body, speech and mind to become a fit vessel for meditative concentration. Then generate as a precursor the conventional awakening mind accompanied by the beneficial qualities of meditative stabilization. So what we see here is how to prepare ourselves well at the beginning of a meditation, any sort of meditation in fact. And what I'd like to do is to go through this as it's presented within the Lam Rim. And here, when we begin a meditation, we can talk about 6 preparations, 6 things we do to prepare ourselves well for any meditation practice. The first step mentioned in the Lam Rim is to clean the place, meaning where we meditate, to have a nice, clean area. Of course, ideally, it would be best to have a separate room. If at home we have a spare room, we can set that up in a very nice and clean way for meditation. Probably many of us don't have the luxury of a spare room where we live. Then what's recommended is set aside a corner of a room for meditation and only have that for meditation. So you associate yourself with meditation when you go there. Because if you simply flop down and sit on your bed to meditate, usually you associate your bed with sleeping, so you're probably going to have a nice little sleep meditation if you sit on your bed to meditate. So very much recommended to have a separate place to meditate and make it clean, make it nice, make it comfortable so that you'll want to go there. You know, if we have sort of a messy, cluttered place, stuff everywhere, that sort of disturbs the mind a little bit and not going to be very helpful for meditation. So if you have a very nice and clean and comfortable place, inspiring, we'll want to go there and meditate. So that's the first step. The second step is to make offerings. So generally, in the Tibetan Buddhism, we have an altar where we meditate, and we have one actually right here. And usually we put offerings on the altar. And the Indian tradition is that in ancient India, if someone important came to your house, you would typically make seven offerings to them. And first, of course, you would offer them some water so they can wash their hands and feet from their journey. Then you would offer them some water for drinking. Then usually you would put around some flowers, very nice looking flowers. You would often make the room smell very nice by lighting some incense. You would often have a lot of lights, so it's very much very a light where in the room. Then you would often give them some perfume to anoint their body. And then you would offer them, of course, some food to eat. And then usually you would offer some entertainment, some music to listen to. So these eight things were very traditional in ancient India that you would offer to an important guest if they came to visit. So that tradition then was brought into Tibet in terms of meditation, is that we make these same offerings at the beginning of a meditation practice. And what we can do is put on our altar what's called, and we'll talk more about that shortly, we can put like what's called the merit field. But also can be very helpful. This can be very extensive, or we can make it very simple. For example, if we have a personal teacher, we can just put a picture of them on the altar in front of us to inspire us when we meditate. Very traditional, so very simple approach. Don't know if we have it on here. Not really. Sort of, a little bit here. But often you would, to symbolize for Buddha, we can talk about body, speech, and mind of an enlightened being. And to symbolize the body, speech, and mind of an enlightened being, we would typically put a statue of a Buddha in front on the altar. That would be symbolizing the body of the Buddha. The speech of the Buddha we would symbolize by having a text, a particular text. And then the mind of Buddha, usually in Tibetan Buddhism, is symbolized by a stupa. So we see a stupa over there on the side. So often you'll see on a Tibetan altar a statue of a Buddha, a text, and a stupa, symbolizing body, speech, and mind of enlightened being. And again, we can also have a picture of our teacher there to inspire us. If we don't have a teacher, we can put a picture of the Buddha if that inspires us, or some other person who really, maybe Dalai Lama, someone who really inspires us in our practice. And then often as well, with the picture of the Buddha, remember the two wings of practice is wisdom and compassion. To symbolize the two wings of compassion, the two wings of practice of wisdom and compassion, often on an altar, you'll also see a picture of Manjushri, the sword in the right hand. He's the Buddha of wisdom. And on the other side of the altar, symbolizing compassion, either Chenrezig, Avalokiteshvara, the Buddha of compassion, or sometimes Maitreya. So sometimes also on an altar, you'll have the Buddha in the middle, and then either side, Manjushri, and then maybe Chenrezig or Maitreya, symbolizing wisdom and compassion. So these are some variations that you'll find on an altar. And so then when you make these offerings, you would offer it to whoever you have displayed on your altar, your teacher, the Buddha, and so forth. And these eight offerings, typically in ancient India, in ancient Tibet, were done in forms of water bowls. Because in ancient Tibet, people generally had hardly anything to offer. You know, they didn't really have incense or perfume and so forth. So they symbolized all of these things by offering. So everyone had some sort of bowl and everyone had access to water. So they would lay out these seven or eight bowls. So sometimes you'll see seven bowls, as is the case here. And then often at the end you'll see a conch shell, which is symbolizing the music offering. So you can lay out seven or eight bowls and fill with water. And of course, the idea being when we make this offering, not to be miserly, to offer the best we can. And so therefore, what you find is that to sort of symbolize that they're not being miserly, then one thing that was sort of available in Tibet but very precious and expensive was saffron. And so they put a little bit of saffron in the water to show that they're not being miserly. So that's why often you see the water bowls are yellow or orange color, because it's got saffron in there to symbolize that. So we have these offerings, and sometimes in the water bowls, you know, you'll actually have where there's food, you may have some biscuits, where you have the light, your little candle, where there's incense and incense stick. So you can be very elaborate with that if you want. So the idea, of course, of doing this offering at the beginning of a meditation is to develop generosity. Because generosity, of course, is one of the main practices. It's one of the six perfections that we are to practice. And of course, material generosity is one of the easiest forms of generosity. So it really starts us to help us to develop those practices to overcome miserliness. So that's the second point, is to make offerings then on the altar. And then the third point, and that's now where we start to see them being described in the text here. Where we talk about preparing body, speech, and mind. So the third point is to take a seat, get a comfortable posture, and then prepare ourselves mentally and develop a positive motivation. So, of course, here this Lojong practice is part of the Mahayana. So the motivation we're trying to cultivate for all of our practices, of course, is bodhicitta. So a couple of things to say here. So we see this in the text a bit. It says, and having seated yourself comfortably on your meditation cushion, count your respiration, exhalation, and inhalation 21 times. So here then, of course, first is to have a good posture. And, of course, the recommended posture with the legs is the full lotus, you know, both feet on opposite thighs. But most of us in our modern society are not that flexible. We can't really do that. So then, of course, you can do like a half lotus, or you can just simply sit cross-legged if you're not flexible enough. And there are a number of things to go through in the posture, but if we keep the posture simple, two things are important. First, to keep the back nice and straight, because if we're sort of bending over like this, there's a high likelihood of we're going to get very dull and sleepy. So keep the back nice and straight, and then allow the entire body to become completely relaxed. Because we want to get into a posture whereby our body's not creating any problems for us. So if we have, of course, a lot of aches and pains in the body when we're sitting, this is not going to be very helpful for meditation. We're just going to be completely distracted by the aches and pains in our body. So we really need to make sure or work on getting a good posture. No point in looking good, you know, having a straight back and that, and you've got to have a lot of pain in the lower back, a lot of pain in the knees and so forth. No point. No point at all. So really find a posture that works for you. If you have knee problems, maybe you've got a damaged knee, No point sitting cross-legged and having a lot of pain. You're not going to be able to meditate. Then use a meditation stool, maybe. Tuck your feet underneath. If that doesn't work, sit in a chair is fine. If you have back problems and even sitting in a chair creates a lot of pain, lie down in the Shavasana, the corpse posture. Find a posture that works for you. We want to be comfortable and we want to have a good posture. Now, a couple of things more about the posture is the hands. What to do with the hands? Generally in Tibetan Buddhism, we talk about the mudra of meditative equipoise, where we have the right hand resting in the left, thumbs touching, resting in the lap. And that's symbolizing the two wings of practice. Wisdom is the left, compassion is the right, and the thumbs touching symbolizing the fact that we're practicing wisdom and compassion together in a balanced way. If you find that uncomfortable, you can just put your hands on your thighs, that's fine. But that's the one that's usually sort of taught. And generally, of course, with the eyes, to have them slightly open. If you have them closed, maybe you get very drowsy and sleepy. If you have them too much open, too much light, maybe agitation. So that's something that you can play with. Some people in the beginning stages of learning to meditate, if they have really a lot of agitation, they find even having the eyes slightly open is really agitating, then maybe you can start with the eyes lightly closed. But probably what you're going to find as you get into the practice, even though with eyes lightly closed, you maybe start be able to reduce your agitation a bit, you're probably going to find at some point dullness will come in more and more into the practice. Then you're probably going to really have to have your eyes a little bit open at some point. But that's something you can play with. Okay. Is there any questions about posture? Because I think this is something very important. Oh, one thing is, often people, like myself, starting to meditate, very stiff in the back, hips, groin, knees. And so often people get one little thin cushion, they sit on it cross-legged, their knees are sticking up in the air, and their back, they're having to strain to hold their back straight. They have a lot of pain in the lower back, a lot of pain in the groin. If that's the case, like me, you're completely stiff, not very flexible, more cushions. Keep jacking up the cushions so that when you sit, you're not straining to keep the back straight. If you're always straining to keep the back straight, it means you're not enough cushions. More cushions so that when you sit, your back is naturally straight. And the knees should be at least level with the hips, ideally touching the cushion. So you have three points of contact. If your knees are sticking up in the air, very unbalanced, and generally then we have a lot of strain on the lower back. So keep sitting more and more cushions, maybe even this much. I think I started with about that much when I started meditating, and now I've managed to go down about there. So I'm still sort of quite high. So make sure you have enough cushion so that your back is naturally straight, your knees are at least level with the hips, not sticking up in the air, and ideally touching. So there's three points of contact. Okay. So that's a little bit the posture. So nice and comfortable posture. Again, we want to be able to get into a posture where the body's completely relaxed and we can completely forget about the body and focus on the meditation practice. If we're always finding aches and pains in the body, then we're not going to be able to meditate well. So what can be very helpful, of course, is if we have a very stiff body, do some physical body work. Do some yoga, tai chi, qigong, some sort of physical body work to make it more flexible so that we can sit better for longer and meditate well and not worry about aches and pains in the body. And then as part of that, here it says, count your respiration 21 times. So this is for two reasons. The main reason is that sometimes when we come into meditation, our mind is quite agitated, and sometimes we're caught up in a lot of mental afflictions, maybe a lot of negativity churning around in our mind. And then, of course, here it says that one of the first things to do is to cultivate the mind of bodhicitta. Very difficult to do that if our mind is agitated, full of negativity. Very difficult to move from that to bodhicitta. So the step in between is this one here, is to count the breath 21 times. Because if we focus on counting the breath 21 times, we can let go of whatever negativities that are churning around in our mind. So the idea of doing a breath exercise in the preparatory phase here is to simply let go of any particularly negative conceptual states of mind by focusing on the breath. And that will bring the mind into a neutral state. In the Tibetan tradition, often instead of 21 breaths, here is mentioned the 9-round breathing exercise. And this, as I mentioned earlier, this 9-round breathing exercise we can also do at many levels. At a very simple level, at our level, we would simply imagine breathing in through one nostril and then out through the other 3 times and then reverse that and then in through both nostrils and out through both nostrils. And again, the purpose of doing that is by focusing on the breathing, we can let go of any negative states of mind. That 9-round breathing exercise, when we go into the higher practice of Tantra or Vajrayana, can become very elaborate. And it often involves, together with focusing on the breathing, involves elaborate visualizations. We're visualizing what's called central channel and 2 side channels, imagining the breath goes down one and up the other and back, and imagining then that attachment goes out one and anger out the other and confusion out the middle. So this can become very elaborate at the higher levels of tantric practice, and sometimes also involves blocking nostrils and breathing in and out. And again, it's the same purpose, is to bring the mind into a neutral state, to let go of any negative state of mind we come into the practice. So when you sit down to meditate and you find, once you've set up the body and you find your mind very agitated, particularly if it's in a negative state of mind, very helpful to do this breathing exercise, either the 9-round breathing exercise or, as here, count 21 breaths. In some traditions, they just simply say, focus on taking 3 deep breaths and focus on the sensations doing that. So whether it's 3 deep breaths, counting 21 breaths, 9-round breathing exercise, that can be very helpful to bring the mind into a more neutral state. And then from that state, then we can do, as suggested here in the text, is to generate as a precursor the conventional awakening mind, accompanied by beneficial qualities of meditative stabilization. So therefore, then we can really develop the positive state of mind. And this is where we can also look in the prayers for meditation now. So in our meditation practice, we can use this as a basis. First, we clean the place, we make offerings, we sit down, we have a good posture, and then we can develop the positive motivation. So we can go through here. And generally for this motivation, we often have it together with refuge. So generally in the Mahayana, particularly in Tibetan Buddhism, when we set a positive motivation at the beginning of a meditation practice, often you'll have this, as we see in the second paragraph, this 4-line going for refuge and generating bodhicitta prayer, where it says, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. Through my practice of giving and the other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So of course the 3rd line is there, is the practice of the 6 perfections. So the first 2 lines is refuge, 2nd 2 lines is bodhicitta, and generally we go through that 3 times. Now, it's very easy, of course, if we have this at the beginning of a meditation, is just to rattle off this verse very quickly. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, through my practice of giving up, become Buddha, and something else. Okay, done. What's next? And of course, if we do that, no purpose. I mean, we're just mindlessly reciting words. So the whole purpose of this is to develop a positive state of mind, develop the good motivation. So if we're just rattling off this verse 3 times and not reflecting on it, then there's no point. So therefore, as we saw here, we need preliminaries. So to help us avoid doing that, particularly in the Kagyu tradition, we see these 4 thoughts come first in the prayers for meditation. So once we've sat down and had a good posture, Then we go through these four thoughts, line by line, and we may spend a minute or so reflecting on each of those points. So that at the end of reflecting on those points, our mind will be turned towards practice and away from chasing after sense pleasures. Which means if we've done that reflection, then when we do this verse, it will have some impact. We'll be really going for refuge and really generating this motivation of bodhicitta. And then to help with that, also we see often here these four immeasurables. Because these four immeasurables are the basis of the compassion wing in the Theravada, which is the basis of here. So therefore also we'll see these four immeasurables, where it says, may all beings have happiness and the cause of happiness. This is, of course, is loving kindness. May they be free of suffering and the cause of suffering, compassion. May they never be separated from the happiness that knows no suffering, empathetic joy. May they dwell in equanimity, free of attachment and aversion to those near and far. So this is equanimity. So therefore, also to help us to develop the positive state of mind, positive motivation, we can go through this four-line prayer, the four immeasurables. So this is what's being talked about here at the beginning, to generate the conventional awakening mind, accompanied by the beneficial qualities of meditative stabilization. So what's being said here is that we are also, in terms of preparing body, speech and mind, we are also making it so that not only do we have a positive motivation, but that our mind is calm, clear and focused. So meditative stabilization here is another word for shamatha, that we want to, at the beginning of a meditation, not only have a good motivation, but to enable our mind to be in this very calm, clear, focused way. So that then we can, when we enter into the main practice, and here it's Vipassana, of course, later it's bodhicitta, then we have the best possible state of mind to enter into this practice. So this is the third step. And then the fourth step is to visualize what's called the merit field. Because the next part in the prayers for meditation is we see this seven-limb prayer here, which was mentioned, this seven-limb practice is mentioned here in your text as well. And the purpose of this seven-limb prayer is, again, as part of preparing the mind and as actually a support for any practice. And we're going to see this again later in the text, is very helpful to purify our mind of negativity and increase the positive state of mind. And so that's what the seven-limb prayer is for. To do the seven-limb prayer, we do that with respect to what's called the merit field. Because here, when we engage in virtuous actions, this is called accumulating merit. Merit is the result of virtuous action. So this seven-limb prayer we do with respect to what's called the merit field. Now that merit field that we visualize can be very extensive. And here's an example. This picture here is a very extensive merit field. I think in the middle looks like Lama Tsongkhapa, the founder of the Gelug school of Tibetan Buddhism. And then all above it you have all the lineage lamas, all the lineage masters back to the Buddha. And then on the one side, you have all the masters in the wisdom side of the practice, the compassion side of the practice. And then also below, you have, I think, a lot of deities that are used within the tantra level of practice. So this is a very extensive way of visualization. And particularly when we go into the higher levels of tantra or vajrayana, often that we have this very extensive way of visualizing. I think at our level, we want to keep it simple and effective. So for us, a merit field can be simply the historical Buddha, for example. It could be our own teacher, if we have a teacher who inspires us. If we don't, it could be the Dalai Lama. And again, also it could be the historical Buddha, and then symbolizing the two aspects of our practice of wisdom and compassion, Manjushri on one side and Chenrezig on the other is another example. Or if we don't have a teacher and we don't really connect with the Buddha, some inspiring master who really inspires us, maybe Lama Tsongkhapa, maybe Padmasambhava, or someone historically in Buddhism inspired, Nagarjuna or someone, or Shantideva, we can visualize them in front of us. And so that's what this visualize the merit field is we visualize them in front of us, and then we do this seven limb prayer. So that is the next step, is to do this seven limb prayer then. And again, the purpose of this seven limb prayer is to increase the positive state of mind and decrease the negative state of mind. What's often called accumulation and purification. And we'll look at those two topics in more detail, I think, in the fourth or fifth point of the seven points. But again, here we see the seven limb prayer. If we have that and we simply mindlessly read through those seven lines, I think that's not really going to do us much good. So we really need to understand what each of those lines is, so that when we do them, it has the appropriate, the corresponding positive effect. So let's go through these seven lines and see what each one of them means. So the first line, it says, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech and mind. So this is what's called prostration. And this is for a couple of reasons we do this. And of course here we're mentally prostrating, we're bowing down. And of course, this is not some sort of idol worship or something. Is that, again, let's say that it's our teacher that we've visualized in front of ourselves. So we're not somehow worshiping our teacher. This is not the purpose of this at all. The idea here of prostrating or mentally bowing down is to think about the positive qualities that our teacher or whoever we visualize in front of us, to think about their positive qualities, the qualities that we would like to develop. And then we're sort of mentally bowing down to those qualities that we really want to develop, that we see in our teacher or the Buddha or whoever we visualized in front of ourselves. And by mentally bowing down to this also, very helpful for overcoming this sort of pride or arrogance, you know, thinking that we're sort of better than we really are. And there's a very nice saying that I like that says, the harvest of good qualities does not grow on the rocky peaks of pride. So if we have a very arrogant, high pride mind, we generally don't learn from anyone because we think we're better than everyone else. So actually what happens is it blocks us from learning and progressing. And so, you know, the harvest of good qualities does not grow on the rocky peaks of pride. Where does it grow? The harvest grows well in the low fertile valleys where it's very fertile. And so the low fertile valleys is the valleys of humility. So if we can really overcome this sort of puffed up state of mind, thinking we're special and be quite arrogant, then we can't learn from anyone because we think we're better than everyone else. And that really blocks us in ours. So if we can let go of that through these sorts of practices of mentally bowing down and develop humility, then we can learn not only from our teacher, but we can learn from everyone. And that's what we're going to see later when we look at these adverse conditions, is the people who we can potentially learn most from are the ones who challenge us, the ones particularly who behave badly toward us. Because without them, it's very difficult to develop, for example, patience. If everyone's nice and kind to us, there's no way we can develop patience. These are the very people who can help us. And then, of course, if everyone's nice and kind to us and we never develop any mental afflictions, we can come to this false idea that, oh, I never get angry anymore. I've overcome my anger. You know, I'm a very, everything's going well. I have no mental afflictions anymore. And then, of course, if someone comes and verbally abuses you and then you react, then you realize, oh, hang on, maybe I've still got something to do here. So they actually highlight to us where we're at in the path. And so that's one of the things we're going to see later in the Lojong, is that the very people who challenge us or who behave badly toward us can be our greatest teachers, in fact. But of course, if we have this pride and arrogance, then not only we're not going to learn from them, we're not even going to learn probably from our teacher, because we think we're better than everyone else. So this prostration is very helpful for this. The second line, it says, I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. So here again, the same idea as offering on the altar, the second point, is that we mentally make an offering to our teacher, whoever we have visualized in front of us. Often in the text here, it talks about imagining the universe full of jewels or flowers or something like this, and offer all of this to the merit field, the teacher, whoever we have in front of us. Now, of course, if we've visualized our teacher in front of us, what offering would the teacher be most happy with? What is the best offering we can give our teacher? What is the thing that would most make our teacher most happy?
To listen
to him. Sorry?
To listen to him.
More than that.
Practicing?
Practice.
I remember this one from last time.
Exactly. That's what's going to make our teacher most happy, if we offer them our practice, if we do follow their advice and guidance. That's what's going to make them most happy. So here, when we do this offering, of course we can do this very elaborate visualization of offering the universe, but really what we can do is we can say, I'm offering you my practice now. That would be very powerful. The third line, I declare all my negative actions accumulated since the beginning of time. So this is here the purification. To basically not only declare and regret negative behavior, but to go through what's called the four opponent powers. And we're going to look at those four opponent powers. They come up later in the text, so I won't go through them here. But here, it says, I declare all my negative actions accumulate since beginningless time. Here, I think what can be helpful to make it very practical is to, when we're doing this as part of a morning meditation session, is to maybe think of one negative thing we've did in the last 24 hours and then declare that and say, I acknowledge I did this harmful thing, I regret it, and then go through the four opponent powers. So we're going to look at how to go through those four opponent powers later. But here I think it's good to also make it practical, because it's easier to say, I declare all my negative actions accumulate at the beginning of time. But if we make it very specific, it can be also very powerful. And then the fourth line is, I rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. So this is this rejoicing in our own and others' virtues. So here again, of course, we can rejoice in our own teachers' practice and so forth. But here also, I think, to be very practical, we can also rejoice in the good things that we do. Because again, as I said earlier, often in our modern society, we're always focusing on the negative, 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 negative. So here, if we can think again, maybe one very good thing we did in the last 24 hours and rejoice about that, to be happy that we've done that. And then make a determination to do that again the following day. So that can be a very practical way of rejoicing, not just rejoicing in all the good things we see other people doing, but also rejoice in the good things that we are doing. And then the next two lines go together, and this is called requesting and beseeching. And it says here, please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for sentient beings. So here we are requesting, beseeching, we could use the word often used, asking our teacher to not disappear from our life, to stay and continually help us and not leave, and then to turn the wheel of Dharma for sentient beings. So here we are asking our teacher to remain with us, to not leave us, and then to continue to teach us, to continue to give us advice and guidance. And particularly these two points are very powerful way of meeting a teacher if we don't have one right now. Often we hear in Buddhism that when you're ready, a teacher will appear. And so sometimes we have this idea then, you know, we'll be sitting at home, there'll be a knock on the door and we open it, and then there'll be a person with a halo around their head saying, I'm here to help you. I think that's not going to happen. If we really want, if we don't have a personal teacher and we really want one and we want to be receive advice and guidance from one, we need to do two things. We need to do this. We need to make a strong aspiration to meet a qualified teacher. And then on top of that, of course, we need to look for a qualified teacher. So if we do those two things, we will find a qualified teacher. And together with that, it's very helpful to keep an open mind. Because often we have this preconception about what this qualified teacher is going to look like. And then what can often happen is we meet someone who happens to be actually a qualified teacher, but because they don't fit our sort of idealistic picture of what they should look like, we discount them. Go away, stop bugging me. I'm looking for a qualified teacher, you know. Well, in fact, they're the one, but because they don't fit the picture of our idealistic picture of what that person's going to look like, we sort of miss it. So again, to have an open mind, to make sincere requests to meet a qualified teacher, and then take steps to try and find a qualified teacher. We do those three things, I think we will meet a teacher. And then the last point here is I dedicate all the virtues of myself and others to great enlightenment. So this is the dedication. So these are the seven-limb prayer. And this seven-limb prayer, again, typically you'll find at the beginning of a meditation session here. And again, these 7 points are to either increase the positive state of mind, decrease the negative state of mind, and also make that connection with a teacher. Any question about seven-limb prayer? And then the last of the 6 preparations is to make requests. And we see this in the next 4-line verse after seven-limb prayer here. We have the request verse. So again, we're doing this with respect to the merit field. Again, if we have visualized our teacher. It says, please bless me to cease all deluded minds immediately from disrespect for the gurus to the subtle dualistic conception. Bless me to generate all unmistaken minds instantly, from respect for the gurus to the realization of emptiness. Bless me to completely pacify all outer and inner obstacles. So here we are, and this is often called requesting blessings from our teacher. And then often when people hear about this getting blessings from their teacher or getting blessings from the Dalai Lama, they have a very strange idea about what that means. You know, often people think, oh, if if I go down the temple here, I'll get blessings from the Dalai Lama. And so people think they'll go down and then the Dalai Lama is going to wave his magic wand and somehow they'll see the light or something and they'll have some experience of nature of reality or something. This is not blessings. In fact, I was a couple of years ago with a small group. We had an audience with the Dalai Lama down the temple and he was giving us a talk. And then at one point he said, you know, I can't give you a blessing. Whether or not you get a blessing from me is up to you. And the word blessing in Tibetan is chin lap. Chin lap. And that literally means to transform into a magnificent state. So a blessing is about transforming our mind into a magnificent state. And the only person who can do that is us. No one else can do that. The Dalai Lama may be a stimulus, but it's only us that can receive a blessing. Only we, if we have an open mind. Then, of course, when we see someone, a Dalai Lama, we can transform our mind into a magnificent state. We can be inspired. But it's completely up to us whether or not that happens. From their side, they can't do that. It's only up to us. So here, what we're doing is we are opening ourselves in this request to our teacher, or whoever we have visualized in front of us. We are opening ourselves to them and making this sincere request for them to please give us advice and guidance. And then, if we're open, and usually with this point we do a bit of visualization, we imagine the teacher coming to our head or even maybe dissolving into us. And then if we're very open, we can be completely inspired by that. And then we receive a blessing from our side. And so then if we do that, that blessing transforms our mind into a magnificent state. And that is the optimum state. This inspired, positive state of mind is the optimum state for meditation. So that's what happens after the request, is when we do this request, then we start the main practice, we meditate. And in here, in this case, of course, we're now talking about meditating on emptiness, but it could be on any other practice. So these, down to the request, is what we do at the beginning of a meditation session to put our mind in the optimum state for the actual practice. And so that's what's being mentioned here in the text, bottom of page 3 on the left side that we read through. So any questions about any of that? So to become familiar with these steps, this is actually what you're going to do with Renato this evening in the meditation session. He's going to guide you through these steps. And then we'll be able to reflect a little bit on each of those points to get more familiar with each of these points and why we do them. So he'll be going through them very slowly, so it'll probably take a whole meditation to go through these points, just so that we can become familiar with them, and then we'll know how to use them later in our own practice. Okay. So that is the preparation. And there's some more to say at the top of the right-hand column of page 3. But actually, it's time for an afternoon tea break. So let's take a break now and come back at 3:30. And then we'll start to look at the actual practice, the actual meditation practice.